This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hi, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Minimed School this evening. It's a pleasure to be with you all. My name is Dr. Mahadevan. I work in UCSF, and I'm the director of the Structural and Congenital Cardiac Intervention Program. What I'm going to try and do in my talk this evening is to try and give you a kind of a flyby tour of what interventional cardiology, i.e. able to do procedures in the heart without open heart surgery, can achieve. Many of you might have had family members or relatives who might have had some of these done, so you may be familiar with some of these. Some of these are relatively old, like opening up coronary arteries, which have been there for a number of years, and some of them are relatively pretty new, like implanting heart valves without open cardiac surgery. So what I'll try and do is give you an overview, and I'll take some questions in the end. So what can we do? These are all the things we can do. We can open up coronary arteries, which are blocked. This is something probably some of you in the audience may be familiar. Your relatives might have had this done. Sadly, coronary disease is a disease of aging too. It does catch up with all of us eventually in some degree or the other. And in patients who present with acute heart attacks, the biggest change, which has been there over the past, say, 7 or 8 years, is not to put them on a medication and wait for things to settle down, but to take them to the cardiac catheterization laboratory and open up the blocked artery, which we call primary PCI or what we call STEMI PCI. Some of the Sentinel trials were done originally in Denmark. And I remember as a fellow when I trained in Europe that we used to give a lot of clot bursting drugs of various descriptions and then go and check the artery 90 minutes later to see if these were open or blocked. One thing we realized was only about 2/3 of the arteries roughly opened after these drugs were given. And roughly about a third or thereabouts of them, the drug did not quite work enough to open the vessel. So what they did was they did this study in Denmark where they took these patients to the cath lab and try and open the artery. And like any new technology, there was a lot of opposition to it. And this is dangerous. The patient is in a very critical state. They're having a major acute heart attack and people are poking into the vessels and so on. But now, a number of years down the line, we know that is the best possible treatment. You could give it to a patient with an acute heart attack, opening up the artery mechanically in the cardiac catheterization laboratory. The other area, which is my big area of interest, is the congenital and structural intervention of the heart, which is problems inside the heart. The coronary arteries are outside on the surface of the heart. And that includes a number of things we can do now. We can close many varieties of holes in the heart with devices. I'll show you examples of these. We can stent open big arteries like the aorta, the pulmonary artery, you know, which have tight narrowings in them. All this needed surgery in the past era. And the biggest paradigm shift in interventional cardiology practice in the past, say, 7 or 8 years, into which I'll delve quite a lot later in my talk, is implanting heart valves without cardiac surgery. I still remember when the first article appeared, I think it was 2002 or thereabouts, I was a fellow who presented that article in a journal club saying the first ever heart valve in a human being was implanted without open cardiac surgery. And a lot of people mocked it and say this is some kind of, you know, backroom maneuver, this is never going to take off, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But now we know after about 12 or 14 years, after a lot of developments, a lot of stumbling along the way, it's becoming increasingly used. There are certain European countries like Germany where aortic valve surgery is now in the minority, and transcatheter valves, i.e. doing by a catheter procedure, is the majority. That's yet to happen in other European countries and the U.S., but I think over the next decade, you will find the vast majority of heart valves, if my prediction is right, will be replaced by a transcatheter technique rather than by an incision in the chest. So I do have some conflicts of interest for this talk. I'm a proctor for Edwards Life Sciences and for Medtronic pulmonic valves and the Edwards aortic valves. I travel around the world teaching people how to do them. And I'm also a consultant for St. Jude's Medical for some of the closure devices we use. So distribution of the coronary arteries. It's important to know what are the arteries which normally lie in the body and the surface of the heart and how they cause trouble. Most of us have three coronary arteries. There's the right coronary artery, which kind of runs, come off the right coronary sinus and runs down kind of behind the heart. And then there is the left main artery, which is a very vital artery. None of us would be alive if this artery was blocked. And this gives off into two branches. One's called the LAD, which runs right in front of the heart and goes right down to the tip of the heart, which we call the apex of the heart. And then there is the circumflex artery, which kind of goes around the side of the heart and gives off a number of marginal branches. There can be variations in these. This is the most common one. In some patients, the right coronary artery is a smaller artery and the circumflex artery is a much bigger artery. But in all of us, the left main artery and the LAD artery are pretty vital. In fact, this artery in popular sort of literature is called the widowmaker's artery, because when people didn't know how men in their 60s or 70s suddenly drop dead, a lot of autopsy studies shows, you know, they had this artery blocked, they had a major heart attack, no one recognized the condition, they had a little bit of chest pain, and they had a fatal, irregular heart rhythm which killed them. So this artery did achieve notoriety, you know, in the past because of this. So this is the internal structure of the heart. I'm sorry, this is a very busy diagram, but it's useful for you to remember a few things, because I'll be alluding to some of these structures later on in my talk. And essentially, you got to remember there are four important chambers of the heart and four valves. That's the right atrium, which is the right side collecting chamber. That's the right ventricle, which is the right side pumping chamber. And there is a valve in between those two, which is called the tricuspid valve. That's the main left side pumping chamber of the heart, called the left ventricle. And that's the left side collecting chamber of the heart, called the left atrium. There's a valve in between there called the mitral valve. The main blood vessel of the heart, the aorta, comes off from the left ventricle, taking oxygenated blood supplying all over the body. And that's the aortic valve there. And this is the pulmonary valve, where blood comes off the right ventricle and goes into the lungs. So essentially, it is a closed circuit in the sense that you get blood coming up from the veins here into the collecting chamber, passed on through this valve into this right side pumping chamber, getting off into the lung arteries on both sides to get oxygenated in the lung, and then comes back through what we call the pulmonary veins into the left side collecting chamber, the left atrium, then gets sent here down into the main pumping chamber, which is the left ventricle, and then gets pumped out by the aortic valve to go into the circulation, and the whole circuit goes round and round and round. In an adult, the average blood volume is roughly around 5 liters, whereas in a neonate, it's around 30, 40 mils. So you can imagine why a newborn is so fragile and any little blood loss is dangerous, whereas a little finger prick or a cut in an adult doesn't mean anything, but a 5 mil blood loss in a newborn is a terrible thing. So it's very interesting the way this is set up. I won't get into more of the details how it is set up in utero. This is a slightly different arrangement of how blood flows when we are in the womb. But there is a good reason for that, because actually, although the heart pumps, the lungs does not oxygenate when we are in the womb, because all the oxygenation takes place in the mother's placenta. So it's all very clear. Okay. So we'll move on to this primary PCI, or the STEMI PCI, which I said, which is the one we use to acutely open coronary arteries in patients having a heart attack. So UCSF is one of the centers in San Francisco, which does provide the service, or a number of other hospitals too. And this is a 24/7 service. It has to be. You cannot say this is a daytime service of 9 to 5 or 10 to 6. Heart attacks don't choose the times. They come at various odd times. In fact, I was on call last weekend, and I was here almost all Saturday and all Sunday. And Sunday morning, we had two heart attacks in a row, one behind each other. So hard, difficult to predict when these will occur. So you need a full team, the interventional team, the cath lab team, and various supportive staff to do this kind of thing. So what do we do when a patient comes with an acute heart attack? This is a relatively young male in his 60s who came with acute chest pain. And, the EKG readings had shown they had an acute, what we call myocardial infarction, which is a technical name for what is normally known as a heart attack in public parlance. And we go, and looking at the EKG, almost always we can predict which artery is blocked. So when we take them to the cardiac cath lab, we either go through the wrist artery or through the groin artery, and usually get a picture of the vessel which we think is not blocked first, because we just want to make sure that in case if the patient needs emergency heart surgery or something, so on and so forth, exactly what the circulation of this in what we think is a relatively normal vessel. That is a normal right coronary artery, you know, which is going around the heart. It's a huge artery, as you can see. And that artery has got bits and pieces of narrowing here and there, but nothing too terrible. So we are now happy. This looks okay. So we can move on and fix the problem. So here, this is the left coronary artery system. And essentially, as you can see, that is the circumflex artery, which goes around there. And look at here. Is there anything you see there? Is there anything you see there? Nothing. So what's happened is this unfortunate gentleman's artery, the LAD artery, which I also referred to previously, the Widowmaker's artery, is kind of blocked right up there. So now the task for us is to try and reopen this to get blood flowing back to the heart again. Because unlike the brain, the heart can take a little bit of ischemic hit, i.e. without blood supply, it can survive for a few hours, the heart muscle. Not all of the heart muscle, but the area of heart muscle which is devoid of blood supply usually does not die instantly, unlike the brain, which normally after 3 to 4 minutes of lack of oxygen starts dying. The heart muscle usually can survive for a couple of hours without much oxygen. And also bear in mind, there's always a little bit of supply coming from these little branches, you know, from the other areas which can supply this heart muscle. So essentially, this is what we do. We put a wire down this vessel, as you can see, and we're putting up a balloon up here and stretching this artery. And once we do this, so we put a metal mesh called a stent, and look at that now. That's the stent there. Can you see that metal mesh? And that's the wire which has been pulled back. And you see blood flowing very freely. And usually the patients are out of this procedure in about an hour, couple of hours. And they usually go home in 2 or 3 days. In fact, some of them can even go home the following day if they're doing very well. So we moved on from giving all these complex medications, and in the 70s it would be put on a heparin drip and, you know, this and everything else and all the rest of it. Now it's almost a drive-by heart attack treatment. Of course, still heart attacks kill people. Of course they do, because sadly 50% of all heart attack deaths happen within the first 2 hours before the patient reaches hospital. So one of the important things is for people to get medical attention as rapidly as possible and get the artery reopened. Of course, there are cases where the vessels cannot be reopened, mechanical complications can happen, etc. But in the vast majority of patients, we can achieve this outcome and the patients go home within 48 to 72 hours. So moving on, now I'm going to go to sort of a topic which I have an even bigger interest of dealing with structural heart conditions. When cardiac surgery originally started in the 50s and, you know, early 60s, no structural heart condition could be treated unless you had open cardiac surgery. And those were the bad days when heart-lung machines were not very good. And so people needed all these complex operations, and they were in intensive care for weeks on end, months on end, sometimes, and didn't do very well. So, but now we have devices which can close these holes in the heart. The common three types of holes in the heart are what we call the AST, which is the atrial septal defect, which essentially is nothing but a hole between the two collecting chambers of the heart, which you saw in the first slide. Then you have a PFO, which is again a hole between the two collecting chambers of the heart, but is a much smaller hole. And actually, 1 out of 4 adults all have a PFO, which is patent. Normally it doesn't cause trouble, but in some instances it could cause trouble, in which case it may need to be closed. And essentially 25% of this planet's population have a patent foramen ovale, and this is something we were all born with. You know, it usually closes in about 2 to 3 weeks after we are born, but about a quarter of the human population doesn't close. The other type of holes is the VST, the ventricular septal defect, which is a hole between the two pumping chambers of the heart, i.e. the left ventricle and the right ventricle. Again, children born with these holes, if it's a very big hole, they need emergency heart surgery as a child. But some of them with smaller holes, when they become a bit older or grow into adults, we can close them with devices. So, as I said, patent foramen ovale is present in 25% of the populations. And I will show you some images of a patent foramen ovale closure, because this has almost become a day procedure now. So you can close a hole in the heart without the patient even needing to stay overnight. So This is indicated for closure in patients with stroke with no other risk factors. Occasionally, a case of migraine, although this is controversial, this is not approved in the U.S., and even for stroke patients, there is a limited approval for patients who have failed blood thinning treatments, although in Europe, the indications are far more liberal for these closures. And also, in divers who develop decompression sickness, or so-called the bends, if they want to resume their diving, or especially for deep-sea divers, this is something which is very important for them to get this hole closed, because otherwise it predisposes them to the bends with the resurfacing. So this is what is called an intracardiac echo probe, which I have put in through a groin vein up into the heart, and you can see the heart chambers. This is the left atrium, which is the left side collecting chamber. That is the right atrium, which is the right side collecting chamber. You can see the aortic valve, and that is what we call the intraatrial septum. And if I can pause it at the right moment, so if you look at it, there is a tiny little hole there. You can see the color flow going across through it, and I'll show you how we're going to close this. See that little gap there? So what happens is, normally, what we call is a left to right shunt. Blood should always go from this side to that side. So if you give some contrast, bubble contrast, in this collecting chamber, i.e. through a vein in the arm, it shouldn't come in here. But if it does that, then there is a risk, if a small clot comes up from a leg vein, it could migrate through in here and potentially cause a stroke or another problem, you know, because clots in anywhere in the body are not a good idea unless you have a broken vessel, and then it needs to clot to stop bleeding. So if a clot goes through this into this left side collecting chamber, the risk is it could go into one of the brain arteries and cause a stroke. So essentially, we do something called the bubble study. And as you can see, when you give the bubbles, they're just very liberally going into this chamber, which is a cause for concern, because that makes you wonder, actually, if there is a clot which comes through this vein. For example, somebody goes on a long plane flight, gets a DVT, what we call a deep vein thrombosis in the leg, and gets a clot which migrates up here, and what might get trapped in the lung, which can be equally bad too, could go in here and cause a stroke. So essentially what we do is, we can go ahead and cross this hole with a wire. Can you see that? That wire is crossing across this hole. We're going through a leg vein and cross this hole. This is all done while the patient is awake, and actually they can see this live on the echo screen. Some of them prefer to, some of them don't prefer to. But if you really fancy it, you can see the whole closure procedure wide awake and looking at the echo screen, and exactly you can know what is going on. And and what we have done there is put a device and close it. That's a little mushroom-like device, you know, what we call an amplatzer device. And as you can see, that hole is closed. And usually the patient just needs to take blood thinners for a six-month period to make sure the body's own heart cells start lining the device. And after that, we generally stop blood thinning treatment to see how they progress. And usually many of them can go home either the following morning or, you know, if need be, even on the same day. So those are the sort of things. If you had told someone 20 years ago we can close a hole in your heart without open heart surgery, you would have been laughed at. But this has almost become a day procedure technology now. So, okay, you can close all these little things. Can you deal with the big things? You know, the aorta, the pulmonary artery, those are the two big arteries in the body. The aorta, as we know, comes off the main pumping chamber of the heart and supplies the entire body. And the pulmonary artery, you know, supplies the entire lungs. So the trouble is, in a small proportion of patients, the aorta can be narrowed at birth, what is called aortic coarctation. And sometimes, if it is mild in childhood, it doesn't come to the attention straight away. It takes a number of years, and often the presentation is hypertension. So whenever you see a young person with high blood pressure, always look for another reason, because high blood pressure, sadly, is common in older people as the arteries get stiffer and due to lifestyle issues, smoking, diabetes, high cholesterol, etc. But if you see someone who's 25 or 30 with high blood pressure, always start looking for another reason. You know, have they got a narrowing of the kidney arteries? Have they got a narrowing of the aorta? Those are all the things you want to look at. And this can be progressive and detected sometimes only in adulthood. And as I said, silent hypertension can be a presenting symptom. This was previously treated with surgery, but almost 95%, maybe 99% of them, you know, these days in an adult would be treated by stenting, by a percutaneous procedure, again, where we go through the groin artery and put a stent in to fix that. So we've gone through the groin artery here with a wire, and we come through one of the wrist arteries there with another catheter, and we're sitting there, and that's the picture. And see how abruptly the aorta is cut off? Can you see that? And what the body is trying to do is, it's trying to develop its own collaterals, and those are all big vessels, which normally in real life should be tiny branches. but it's opened up all of these to try and supply the lower half of the body because nothing can hardly get through. This is almost what we call the near total occlusion of the aorta. You can see a tiny little passage through which we managed to get a wire up there. And essentially, this is what we do. We've gone with a stent in here across this. And you've got to bear in mind, this orifice is about 2 millimeters when we started off, and that's a 16-millimeter diameter stent. So we have sort of gone ahead about, made it bigger by, you know, 8 times or thereabouts, because you need something of that size to make blood flow freely through. And of course, there is a risk these things can rupture, so we use special stents called covered stents, you know, to try and minimize the risk of the rupture. And that is the final result. If you look at it, look at that aorta now. It's hard to believe that you can achieve all this without ever having to cut open someone's chest. Because we do know when you do surgical procedures, although the outcomes are often very good, the risk of complications are much higher. That is not to say intervention does not carry risk of complications. It does, and sometimes things do go wrong. You can have a tear of the aorta, a rupture of the aorta, which all can be sometimes fatal. But more than often, you can usually get a very good result, and with this, the patient goes home the following morning. So I'm just going to introduce a bit of history to you. I mean, probably most of you in this audience know a little bit about Charles Dickens, The Tale of Two Cities. So I'm going to tell you a tale of two valves, you know, and how valve therapy came into being. And I've just borrowed a bit of analogy from Dickens, who was probably one of the most famous storytellers who's lived on this planet. So the percutaneous valve implants developed in France. This is truly a French revolution. The first pulmonary implant was done by Philip Bonhoeffer in the Necker Hospital in Paris. I was privileged to know this man personally, and in fact, he came and helped me do my first implant in 2007 in England. And the first aortic implant was, as I said, in 2002, was done by Alan Kribbe in Paris, who's still alive and is very much active, you know, goes around giving talks. So actually, whether we like the French or not, you know, we do owe them a debt of gratitude because it was them who developed this technology. And the first implants in England were done in 2002 in the Great Ormond Street Hospital in children in London. So the patient populations are two different things. For the pulmonic valves, it's young adults who have had previous heart surgery, born with a congenital heart condition as a child, usually have had multiple cardiac surgeries, often more than one. And the aortic valves is the other end of the spectrum. It's elderly patients, people who are octogenarians or nonagenarians, who have multiple comorbidities. You know, the heart, the narrowed heart valve is only one among the problems. They have kidney failure, they have lung problems, they have, you know, liver problems, you name it. You know, so essentially, they're completely two different populations in which we implant these valves. And so, if going back to Tale of Two Cities, I don't know how many of you have read it, but this is a bit like the Charles Darnay population. Charles Darnay was a dashing young guy. You know, he was the in thing in that novel. And this is a bit like the Sidney Carton, who was a wise old man. You know, he was a guy who was a fading star. And, you know, he was absolutely, the kind of the done guy. And as you all know, I mean, Sidney Carton eventually saves Charles Darnay's life in the novel. And actually, although the pulmonic valve started first, it's the TAVR technologies which have supported the pulmonic technologies and move things on. And but for TAVR, I don't think the pulmonic valves wouldn't exist here simply because commercially all companies will tell you it's simply unviable for us to run a pulmonic valve thing because the numbers are small, there's a huge outlay. So it is essentially interesting how parallel technologies can support each other and make things better. So what valves are currently available? I don't get a great deal into this, but these are the only valves which are licensed in the United States. There are a number of other valves in Europe, but at the moment in the United States, the Melody valve is licensed for pulmonic use. The Edwards Sapien valve is not licensed for routine pulmonic use. It can be used as an off-label. We do use it in our institution here for select cases where no other option is available. The aortic valve, these two valves are licensed in the U.S., the Edwards Sapien valve and the core valve. So, but there are about half a dozen new technologies in Europe which will eventually reach these shores. And when they do, the choice of valves and the type of procedures, the number of patients we can do, will get even better. So the pulmonic valve, when do we put this in? It's essentially the whole idea is to reduce the total number of surgeries over a patient's lifetime, but postponing time to surgery. Because if you look at it, it's, you know, some of your relatives or, you know, friends who may have a congenital heart disease as a child, it's not an easy existence. These children have been in and out of hospital dozens of times with various things, have had two or three heart surgeries, big scars in the chest, and every operation comes with a higher and higher risk. It's not a lower risk. And bear in mind, many of these people are in the prime of their lives. You know, they're 18, 20. They want to go to university. They want to achieve things like all the rest of us. You know, they want to live a full life. And having another heart operation and getting stuck for 3 months or two months in a bed and recovering slowly is not an option many of them want. They want to lead a very active life. In fact, you know, there are some semi-professional athletes, you know, we've implanted these valves in, who want to go on and continue with the training and achieve things. Okay, they may not be able to achieve things at the highest level, but that doesn't mean people can't achieve things which they wish to. So this also gives us an option to intervene earlier, because previously what we used to do was postpone surgery till they were really very bad and wait for this and everything else. And we do know that if you wait for a long time, the outcomes are not quite as good as if you got it done sooner. So I won't get into a great deal of this, but essentially the indications are either severe leakage of a conduit, which is a connection which the surgeon puts when they are young between the right ventricle and the pulmonary artery, or a narrowing, or a combination of both. And the whole idea is to retain pulmonic valve function, relieve the conduit narrowing, and extend the functional life of the conduit. So again, just to give you a perspective, about 20% of all congenital heart disease patients will end up needing some sort of procedure, whether it be an operation or a transcatheter valve. And now, currently in the United States, as in most Western world countries, the number of adults who survive with congenital heart disease is higher than the number of children who survive congenital heart disease. Thanks to the success of pediatric cardiology and pediatric cardiac surgery, we have more adults who live longer and longer now with these conditions, but they will need recurrent treatment, you know, from maybe every decade or maybe every 15 years or so for various problems which arise. And I don't think it's a pleasant task to think when you're 25, well, I'm going to have a heart operation every 10 years. It is not something to look forward to. It's not like renewing one's car and, you know, going for a better model. And this is something people dread, you know, going into heart surgery every decade. This is the Melody transcatheter valve, which we use often. This is taken from the bovine jugular vein, and this is crimped onto a platinum stent. So essentially, you can actually crimp it down to 6 millimeters. When it expands, it can go up to 22. So essentially, technology has advanced that we can actually crimp this down on a delivery system. And this is the delivery system we use. As you can see, the valve kind of sits there under a protective sheath. And then there are various balloons which we can use to expand it. And then we take this up through the groin vein. And I'll show you a procedure. This is the kind of patients we do this. This is a 17-year-old female who was referred to me with previous tetralogy repair. Two previous cardiac surgeries, including a conduit from the right ventricle, which is the right side pumping chamber, to the pulmonary artery, which is the lung artery. It's had a stent put into the left pulmonary artery. Has previous endocarditis, which is an infection of the pulmonary valve, the surgically implanted one. So it's developed severe leakage of the pulmonary valve, which we call free severe PR, with stretching of the right side pumping chamber. Significant impairment of exercise tolerance. In fact, she used to work as a swimming coach somewhere, but she found that, you know, increasingly that was becoming very, very difficult. So the option was further surgery or a pulmonic valve implant, which we call PPVI. And she was very clear, you know, I don't want any more operations. I've had enough of these. If I still need one in my adult life later on, maybe I'll consider it. But if you can do something without surgery, you know, please do. So essentially, this is what we do. We bring them into the cardiac cath lab. We put them to sleep. And then we go through the groin vein and cross the conduit here. And there is a catheter there, and the valve is supposed to be there. But this valve has been destroyed in this patient's case because of severe leakage. And see how freely contrast fills back into the right ventricle. Just keep that picture in mind, because I'm going to show you a picture a bit later on to show how we treated this. And there is so much leakage of contrast. So essentially, this valve is virtually non-functional. So you can imagine this ventricle, almost half of what, or maybe even more, what it throws out just comes back to it. So after a while, the heart cannot cope with it. It starts stretching and stretching and stretching, and eventually will fail. So that's the reason why we need to replace this valve. And essentially what we do is we've gone up with a stented Melody valve here, which we've gone up, and we're deploying it with a balloon. As you can see, it goes up. And in some cases, we put a stent in before we put the valve. In fact, in many cases, we do that now because these valves can fracture sometimes. And then, if you look at the picture now, just closely watch, that's a functioning valve. Do you see anything coming back? Nothing at all. Blood is flowing the way it should from the ventricle right down into the lung arteries, all the way down, and this patient can go home the following day, which would never be possible with open heart surgery. So I will go to the transcatheter aortic valve, which is kind of all the rage now, in the sense that a lot of elderly patients who are unsuitable for surgical aortic valve replacement can now be considered for this therapy. As I said, the first procedure was done in 2002. And aortic stenosis is actually a pretty bad condition. This is the narrowing of the aortic valve. Sadly, you know, this is a condition, again, of aging because of degeneration, of calcification, calcium forming in the valve. And in a small proportion of patients who have worn an abnormal valve, this can happen to what we call the bicuspid aortic valve. So if you look at it, often it doesn't cause any symptoms while this is progressing. And then suddenly, when you get your symptoms, you kind of your survival starts dropping rapidly. So patients always find when you come up to the clinic and, oh, you know, I've had a blackout, I'm feeling short of breath, and then you tell them your outlook beyond this is very bad. They think, really? I mean, I've had this a little bit, you know, every now and then, and I'm fine. You know, I've had this for 5 years, 7 years. Why the heck you want to do something on me now? This is why. Because we do know from studies that after onset of symptoms, only half of the people are alive at 2 years, and only 20% are alive at 5 years. So actually, this is worse than many cancers left untreated. Because if you look at it, we all know of relatives or friends who've survived with prostate cancer, with breast cancer, and various other things for a decade or even longer, you know, with appropriate treatment. And here we have a heart condition which potentially can be treated in patients who are unsuitable for surgery, who often don't get referred or often, you know, don't want anything doing because they think, you know, I'm not feeling too bad. So essentially, if you look at the mortality figures with standard therapy, i.e., if you get a little water pill or a little some other pill and, you know, you'll be fine, you carry on, this is your mortality. Your mortality is pretty bad, and this is survival. So the higher the curve, the better. That's breast cancer survival. You know, it's much, much way ahead of untreated aortic stenosis, which has not been operated on or nothing has been done. Even ovarian cancer does better. Prostate cancer does much better. Even colorectal cancer does much better. And it's almost as bad as lung cancer, you know, in terms of outcome if you don't treat it. So this is a condition, even if you're old, it's worth treating. It may not extend your life by a huge extent, but it'll improve your quality of life and certainly, you know, lessen your chance of dying because of this condition quite remarkably. So we do it in many ways. What we call the transfemoral approach is one where we go through the groin artery and then implant a valve. And we also have the transapical approach where we go through the apex of the heart through a direct incision. We also have something called the transaortic approach now, which we use a lot here, where the surgeon makes a little incision at the top half of the sternum here, and we go through a little catheter and implant a valve. And I'll show you some pictures. This is the Edwards Sapien XT valve, which was one of the first valves approved in the U.S., which is now used. You can treat it from 18 to 27 millimeters in diameter, which is pretty much covers most of the population. The really small annuli occur in people of Far Eastern origin, and Edwards do have a special valve for them, a 20-millimeter valve, because you have very small, petite Asian women who have very small aortic annuli. And there is a small proportion of big-built men who may have bigger annuli who still may not be able to receive treatment with this. But as technology improves, we will be able to treat more patients with these conditions. So essentially, if you have a valve area of 0.8 square centimeters, a normal aortic valve area is usually greater than 2. It's related to your body surface area. If you're a big guy, you have a bigger valve. If you're a small person, you have a smaller valve. And that's kind of related to your body surface area, but it's generally accepted if it falls below 0.8 square centimeters in anyone, that's considered severe narrowing. There are a lot of risk scores, you know, which we use, and I won't get into great detail in this, what we call the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, the Euro score, and, you know, these are all the risk modifiers which we use to see how risky it is if you have a surgical operation. And, you know, we don't have an absolute age limit. In fact, the oldest person I have deployed a valve in, somebody who was 91, who actually, a month after the procedure, came back to the clinic and said, I feel perfectly fine, I'm doing what I want to do now, you know, and I am, and you know, I feel very happy I got this done, you're giving me back my life. So essentially there is no absolute age limit. In fact, I have a 93-year-old in my patient, you know, in my clinic, who is absolutely dead keen to get this done. He says, I've lived a very good life, you know, and I want to carry on. And his brain is as sharp as a whip. And, you know, there is no reason why people shouldn't be treated, you know, because they're elderly, unless they have some absolute contraindication why they cannot be treated. Often many of these patients have a combination of several illnesses. It's not to say they're all in pristine health. And often there is a contraindication to surgery because they've had previous chest radiation, or when we mean porcelain aorta, that usually means the surgeon can't do anything because the whole aorta is completely calcified. It's like a piece of rock. If you look in the CT scan, you can see calcium extending all through it. The surgeon cannot go and operate on the aorta because if he opens the aorta, he won't be able to close it because there's nowhere a stitch is going to take for him to close. And, you know, there are a lot of various workups we do. You know, we do echo scans, we do CT scans. Now we have 3D reconstructions, which will give you a real-life image. Actually, you can rotate this image 360 degrees and see exactly how the artery looks. So the amount of info we can get out of these things is phenomenally good. So for the transfemoral route, we still use general anesthesia in this country, and we use a transesophageal echo. We do put tubes in groin arteries and groin veins because we need to pace the heart, i.e. make the heart beat fast while we deploy the valve. Otherwise, the valve will move out of position and embolize. And similarly for the transapical route, where we go through the apex of the heart, we make a little incision here. And so this is the sort of classical patient we get. You know, this is a sort of typical story, 88-year-old man, history of prostate problems. And he had a large bowel lesion. He was investigated for anemia, and they found that he had a cancer there which needed resecting. So they started working him up, and then they found he's got severe aortic stenosis. The risk scores are very high. So we decided to do a TAVR as the best option for this patient than going through open-heart surgery with a lurking cancer inside, because bear in mind, for open-heart surgery, again, you need huge amounts of blood thinners during the procedure, which can make you bleed even worse. So this is the sort of way we do this now. What we do is, you know, we go through the other femoral artery and even pick and choose where we want to puncture the artery, where we're going to put this, you know, device through. So we've chosen a point here. It's a little bit calcium there, so we're going to go a little bit higher there. And what we do is we get an angiogram from the other side that shows the aortic valve. Those are all the coronary arteries, as you can see. There's the temporary pacemaker wire, which we will use when we deploy the valve. So essentially, we're going ahead and with the system, and we got a valve deployed in the right position here, and we're going to rapidly pace the heart, as you can see, and slowly deploy this valve. So that's the valve deployed, and as you can see, that's the angiogram, and look, we got a perfectly functioning normal valve. And actually, these patients are woken up on the table. They don't even leave the OR without being awake. With the transfemoral procedure, they're woken up on the table. And then we don't do any cutdowns for the femoral arteries or anything. We use ProGlide sutures to close them. And then if you look at it, that's the artery through which we went. You can't even see the site where we went through. So essentially, this is the level of technology we can use. Of course, at the risk of complications, there are. I mean, you know, there are things when things can go wrong. There's an overall mortality risk of around maybe 3-5%, although that risk is now coming down with the newer devices, maybe to 2%, 3%. So essentially, now the question is being asked is, why are we restricting this only to high-risk patients? Can we not do intermediate-risk patients, low-risk patients? Because the outcomes are almost comparable to cardiac surgery. So this is a situation where you cannot go through the groin arteries because the groin arteries are heavily diseased. So what do you do then? This patient had a previous stroke as well, the disease of the carotid, which is the neck arteries, obesity, hypertension, so very large aortic roots. So essentially what we do is we go through the groin artery just to get a picture. You need only a small tube for that purpose. The temporary pacing wire is here. And as you can see, the surgeon has made a direct opening in the apex of the heart, and that's a tube in there, and we've taken a valve up through that. So essentially, this is what we call the transapical approach. And then we deploy the valve, and we do an angiogram. And as you can see, the valve is deployed. The procedure is completed. The surgeon closes the hole in the apex, and the patient is woken up in the intensive care a few hours later. The only reason we keep them asleep is because it can be quite painful in the chest wall, so we want to give them enough analgesics to make sure they are free. So in this study, I mean, I won't bore you too much with statistics and details, but there is a 20% reduction in death at 1 year. I mean, in any medical study, as a general rule, to prove a benefit in mortality is tough. You need big numbers of patients, but even at a relatively what we would think of a small study by conventional medical standards, you see with standard therapy, your mortality is approaching 50% at 2 years. With the TAVR, it's much lower, around 20-25%. A lot of these patients die not due to the heart disease, but due to other conditions eventually, because the lungs are bad, or the liver is bad, or they've got bad kidneys. But then what you can buy them is 2 or 3 years of high-quality life, which many of them enjoy and feel very grateful for. So this was the sort of cost estimate of the TAVR, which is it is an expensive procedure. This is not a cheap procedure. In California, roughly the tariff varies from somewhere between $65,000 to $120,000, depending on the complexity of the procedure. But you can see, what you don't see with the standard cost is the repeated ED admissions, the repeat visits to physicians, and sadly, none of these come into the system. And if you add this up, you know, it's probably no more expensive than that. So essentially, it was felt a life expectancy of around 2 years and an incremental cost ratio for those who are statistically minded around $50,000 per real life year gained. So there is a price to pay for extending one's life. It doesn't come free, like everything else in life. But then the question is, do we want our elderly patients to be mobile, enjoy a better quality of life, and do better till they probably reach the rent from something else? Or do you want them to end up in an emergency department hospital bed for months on end during the last 2 years of life? So I think that's a question which society has to answer, and there is not necessarily an easy answer. That's a tough road to climb. That's the Khumbu Icefall on Everest. And sadly, you know, sometimes you're on your own in this journey, and you got to make up as you go along. I mean, as you can see, they've strung together about 4 ladders, and it's not easy. So I'll let you read this for 1 second. It's amazing how Dickens got it right 200 years ago. It's still true. We are still in the best of times and worst of times. We were in the best of times because the technology we have now is amazing, but you could also see in the worst of times because the cost associated with this technology is sometimes prohibitive. And I think the real challenge for not only for physicians but also governments maybe is how to make this accessible to everyone, you know, at a reasonable price, to everyone on this planet. You know, at a reasonable cost, so that nobody is denied, you know, appropriate health care. And I think that I don't think is an easy challenge which can be addressed, but I think that's something all of us should be concerned about, because we have the technology now to do a lot of things, and the trick is how do you make it accessible to everyone who needs it. So we have now gone beyond the aortic and pulmonary valves, because I did the first in human of a native mitral transcatheter valve, which we published in one of the journals in 2013. So we can offer now for the mitral and tricuspid valves as a valve-in-valve therapy. We have done cases here in UCSF. And there's also potential therapies for native mitral valves, or at least 2 trials which have started in Europe, which are in progress and eventually will reach the shores at some point. And as you can see, this is a very interesting case of a very young female who had an infection of the mitral valve and then had a bioprosthesis and had a dense stroke because of the clot in the mitral valve at that stage, then went on to have a tissue mitral valve, as you can see, and then had 2 pregnancies and eventually came back 7 years later with a very degenerate valve, and she didn't want another heart operation. She was clear, I've had a previous stroke, I've been through so many, I've got 2 young kids, I cannot go through another heart surgery. So essentially, we went ahead and did what we call a transapical catheter valve-in-valve. So we've gone through the valve here, we put a balloon just to check the size of it, and here we are implanting a valve inside a tissue valve which has been implanted surgically. And as you can see, that's the angiogram and shows absolutely no leakage, a perfectly functioning valve, so all the blood is not going back into this atrial chamber, but it's going straight up into the aorta where it should be going, and she goes home on day 3 or day 4. So essentially, this is the sort of things which we can do now. And as you can see, the heart is not a very forgiving organ. See the amount of thrust it's giving to that. So you've got to really get this right. This is not to be performed in smaller institutions by less experienced operators simply because, you know, these are all very high-risk procedures. In the right hands, these yield very good results. But in the wrong hands, these can also go terribly wrong. So essentially, you know, it is a question of the team, the surgical backup, the operator skill, a number of things, but the technology is now there that we can treat a lot of patients without open heart surgery to achieve these things. So imaging has also come along a great way along with this. That is a 3D reconstruction of a valve function on echo, a valve which we implanted. That's a prosthetic valve. You can see the stent struts there and see how beautifully you can see the valve leaflets in three dimension, you know, opening and closing. So essentially, the amount of imaging data we get now is phenomenally good, and this has completely transformed the way we do procedures, because the amount of guidance you can get with these things is very, very good. So that's a picture of the deep space field from the Hubble telescope. So I think there is a lot to look forward in the future. I think we are still only early days. We've only got a glimpse. I think this is only the beginning of a great journey, I think, for all of us. And thank you very much for your listening. Often defective valves are progressive things, you know, except in certain situations. Often the two main symptoms are either shortness of breath or slowly decreasing exercise tolerance. I mean, if someone tells you, I could walk a mile 6 months ago, a year ago, without any trouble, and now I can walk less than half a mile and I'm panting for breath, you know something is not right. And people often attribute this to aging. Nobody ages within 6 months that rapidly, you know. And also, one of the other things with the aortic valves can be blackouts. You know, if you start developing blackouts suddenly, or you feel you're going to faint, or you feel dizzy, that could be a symptom of it. The third thing which can happen is palpitations. You know, people's feeling fast heartbeats, especially with mitral valve disease, when their heart starts going faster, you know, at time from time to time, because the collecting chambers of the heart are getting stretched, that can be a symptom too. Oh, the material inside the cage, depending on the type of valve, except for the melodies, it's the bovine jugular vein. For the Edwards valve, it's pericardium. You know, it's either taken from human pericardium or it's taken from animal pericardium. You know, so depending on, it's often porcine pericardium, which is used to create the valve. Well, usually, it can get trapped in the lungs. I mean, it's not very uncommon for us to have tiny clots in our legs sometimes. The lung acts as a filter and takes them. If it's a big clot, we get a pulmonary embolus, which is a life-threatening condition, of course. Very tiny clots, you know, get trapped in the lung and they dissolve. But if that clot escapes, or if you get a clot in the tunnel itself, which can escape into the left side of the heart, that can be a dangerous condition, yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't think anyone has addressed that balance very well. What has happened in countries like Germany, where these things have taken on big time, is that the cardiac surgeons have started getting involved in these procedures. I don't think that's happened in the U.S. to a large extent. It's still the interventional cardiologists like myself who do these things. But I think that'll happen. I think what fundamentally, which we realize, needs to change is the way we train our cardiac surgeons now. They cannot be just suture and cut and, you know, close surgeons. They're going to have what we call wire skills, i.e. being able to manipulate things, you know, without necessarily opening them or cutting them. And I think that's what you'll see over the next decade. There will be a shift of how cardiac surgeons operate. And I think that's kind of slowly beginning to happen. Because what I haven't showed you is there are a lot of hybrid procedures which will be published, you know, where in some cases where we cannot go and implant a valve through the femoral or something, the transapical, for example, the surgeon is the one who gets his access, and then we go and implant a valve. So it's actually teamwork. More? I don't see the death of the heart-lung machine anytime soon. I mean, you know, in fact, for some people with very poor heart muscle function, in fact, we did one a few weeks ago here, you know, to replace a valve, we put them on heart-lung machine temporarily when we implant this valve, and then we just take the machine off. So I don't think that is going to go away anytime soon, but, you know, there are more and more smart heart-lung machines because, for example, the classical heart-lung machine is, I don't know if you've seen one, is a huge big thing, you know, which sort of sits in the corner of a room. But the newer heart-lung machines, some of them we use what we call ECMO devices just to provide support to the heart and oxygenate. You know, there are two tubes which come out of the body, but the machine itself is only about that size. So, you know, things are getting better and better. I think it's probably beyond the scope of me now to explain the physics of a heart-lung machine. But essentially what a heart-lung machine does in simple terms is it takes the blood from the veins in your body, puts them through what we call the membrane oxygenator. It oxygenates the blood, and then there is a pump which takes the blood back into your artery and throws it back in for it to circulate in your body. That's the kind of the simple thing it does. Essentially, it takes the blood oxygenate it, and you know, sends it back with pressure back into your circulation so that it can circulate in the whole body. I mean, if you go to the history of this, there's a lot of history, because one of the things we didn't realize until about the 50s or late 40s was, or maybe early 50s, was that we don't need pulsatile flow. Blood flow in the human body is pulsatile in its natural state. But when you put people on a heart-lung machine, the pulsatile waveform you see is gone. It's a flat line. So, but that is something we didn't know for a long time, that actually human beings could survive for a number of hours with having a what we call a non-pulsatile flow. But that's what the heart-lung machines do. So that's an entirely different area of how the human body copes with it, et cetera, et cetera. But, well, that's a good question. I mean, the answer is I don't know. But I think one day I suspect what may happen is we may be able to grow your own valve in either in the laboratory or in an animal, and then take it out and implant it in some way, either through a transcatheter way or a surgical way, you know, whatever, put it back into your heart. That's quite possible. But, you know, apart from the tabloids, I mean, or you know, some ads you might see on TV, none of that is a reality as it stands now. It is my personal prediction is I don't think that'll become a reality, at least for the next decade or two. You know, there is a lot of hurdles in that, and it's going to take a long time before that technology is perfected. This is not, none of the valves are live material. They are all, because one of the things you got to remember is when tissue taken from animals has got a totally HLA antigen in them, so your body will go and start attacking it if you leave it live or leave it. So what happens is these things are treated with a solution called glutaraldehyde, which essentially destroys all the HLA antigens in them. So essentially your body doesn't recognize it as foreign, because there's nothing left in there for it to recognize it as foreign. So essentially it deals with it as normal tissue. Of course, they do suffer mechanical wear, like everything else, yes.
So how does your mechanical wear?
Well, the body actually sadly cannot compensate normally for mechanical wear. That's the reason why we all end up with valve disease, because we are all born with one set of valves, and it's probably the best machine ever produced, because if you think of it, you tell me one human motor which is designed to run for 90 years without stopping. There isn't one. There's not a single human machine ever designed which will run 90 years or 100 or 120, whatever, the longest human being has survived, without stopping. It doesn't happen. But the human body can design and run a device, and bear in mind, the heart starts beating at about 3 months in utero, and the minute it stops, we are gone. So.
The valve has to grow if it's dead. I mean, how does all that work?
Sorry?
The valve has to grow with your heart, right?
So yeah, I mean, that is a whole area of embryology. You know, could be here for hours talking how the heart grows. I mean, there are textbooks on how the heart develops. The heart starts off as a single tube, and then the number of changes it undergoes before it becomes the complex structure it is phenomenal. And then there's a lot of comparative embryology you can look at if you want to, how the heart has evolved from single cell, you know, or from primitive beings to these complex beings, and how the heart changes in massive, you know, organisms like the blue whale and, you know, the elephant. I mean, their heart function is largely similar, but the way it is set up is very different, because you cannot have a human type of heart in a whale which will function. For example, a whale's heart doesn't even beat 70 times a minute, you know. It beats somewhere around 30, 40 times a minute, because...
So the valves I've got in my heart now is exactly the same material when I was a kid?
Yes. It's grown in... Yeah? It's made up of various things like collagen and, you know, endothelium, and, you know, there are a number of things which make up the heart valve, you know, or natural tissues of the body. Well, usually, as I said, you know, there are criteria which we have. I mean, the criteria which FDA mandates for patients to have by echo and so on. And, of course, they've got to be symptomatic too. You know, as I said, decreasing exercise tolerance or syncope or blackouts, as we call them, are two of the commonest conditions which you do it for, or recurrent presentations with heart failure. I mean, that's another indication which we do that to.
So you don't do it if they're not having symptoms?
If they're totally asymptomatic, you know, if you get an 80-year-old with significant aortic stenosis who says, I feel absolutely fine, I can run a mile and I got nothing at all, I would say we'll wait for a little while. Eventually they'll become symptomatic, you know, all of them will. I mean, we do know that, but it's a matter of time, you know.
What's the life of the implant?
That's a good question. We don't know is the honest answer, because we don't have as much long-term data like the surgical valves do. But we do. We are coming to close to now 7 or 8 year follow-up data, and all that looks good. So I would think this will be like any other tissue valve, the surgical tissue valve, somewhere around 10 years, I think, or maybe longer. I mean, the first pulmonic implant I did in 2007 is still working, so we're about 8 years now out now. So I think the longevity is not going to be a huge issue. I think it'll last at least for a decade, and if you think that you're going to put it in very elderly patients who are kind of probably in the last decade of life anyway, I think probably that's not going to be an issue. But in the younger patients, it might be. But then what I haven't shown you is we have done valve in valves now where this fails. We can go and put another stented valve inside the one previously put in. So that's possible too. We're already seeing that. In fact, the big problem I have in my clinic now is the not-so-high-risk elderly patients wanting this rather than wanting open-heart surgery because, you know, the convalescence is shorter, and I try and dissuade them because, you know, A, we don't have an FDA mandate to do that, and B, you know, surgery is still the gold standard. But certainly, yes, for high-risk patients, I think this is a far better option than open cardiac surgery. There's no question. Well, there are a number of minor complications and major complications. You know, the minor complications, you can cause trauma to the vessels you go in. You can cause small tears in them. You know, you can perforate vessels. That's quite possible. And, you know, the biggest risk with TAVR are probably two or three. One is the biggest risk is aortic root rupture, you know, because you've got a very calcified root. You're not like the surgeon who can go and remove some calcium and fix it and put a valve in. He can see it directly. The heart's rested when he does the operation. The heart is not rested. You know, it's rapidly paced. We drop the blood pressure, but the heart is still pumping. And if the root ruptures, that's usually a catastrophic complication. Fortunately, it's very rare with the modern sizing tools. We use CT for sizing and so on. But that's a catastrophic complication. The other risk is always a stroke because we're going and crushing all the calcium and we're crossing the valve. So the worst outcome for a TAVR patient is have a successful valve and end up with a big stroke, you know, because, you know, they've had a very good procedure, but their quality of life has gone down a big drain because they've had a massive stroke or a good significant size stroke. Of course, I mean, the other big complication is valve embolization, where the valve can move after we deployed it, in which case we may have to have open-heart surgery to remove it and replace it. But that's becoming lesser and lesser because now, I haven't shown you, but there are some new valves coming in Europe which are almost 100% retrievable. So you can actually release them, check, wait, make sure they don't move, and then release them. And if you're not happy, you could press another button and recapture the whole thing back into your sheath and take it out. So that's what technology is moving towards. So eventually it'll be a matter of time before we get that. So embolizations will pretty become very small. It's a good question. Ask the FDA.
Is it privately held companies that are?
No, actually, most of them are American companies. For example, Medtronic and Edwards are both American companies. Edwards is actually based in California. They're based in Irvine, which is, you know, a couple of hundred miles from here. But part of the problem is, I mean, having worked in both continents, it's very easy to set up clinical trials and easy to do things in Europe than compared to the U.S. is what they say. I mean, I don't know. I'm not involved in the regulatory authorities. But that's the reason why often you find most of the early trials happen in Europe than in the U.S. And, you know, what has happened in Europe takes about 2 or 3 years often to happen in the U.S. Yeah, that's good in some ways, too, because sometimes you get technology which isn't quite up to as good as it should be, you know, being prevented from, you know, implanting on people. So there are certain advantages to it, too. It's not entirely disadvantageous for that approach. Great. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.